There's an alarm in the background. Are you guys getting that?
That's fine. Yeah.
give me 1 second here. I'll take care of that. Canadian police. Canadian police are very easy to get rid of.
All right. Thank you again for checking us out. Today, we have a very special guest with us. We have a Mr. Michael Chenal of CMON Games. You may have heard of Michael before. He's worked on a number of games we've discussed, including Dark Age. He's also worked on A Song of Ice and Fire, the war game, and the subject of this episode, Wrath of Kings. He also works on various other tabletop war games, board games, and card games at CMON, and he's still currently there as a development manager. So welcome, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, good to be here. And, you know, I have to say just initially, it feels a little strange when it's like, oh, yeah, this is the Dead War Gaming Society, and here's a bunch of games you've worked on. Like, oh,
and this is your life. No,
but granted, like, you know, I've been doing this, you know, actually a decade now, just being in the industry a decade, not just, you know, the amount of time I've been playing. So I guess it's, you know, it's something that happens. I mean, you know, we do a lot of miniature games. I've done definitely a lot over my time, and, you know, the lifespan of them, they come and go. I mean, I still remember like tons that I still like, but you know, they only lasted a couple of years, and some even smaller than that. Of course, hell, that's the entire point. You guys have a podcast based around that.
Yep. Yeah. It's scary sometimes seeing the churn. It always blows my mind, you know, what works and what doesn't just in terms of sales. But hey, you know, things happen. People learn, move on. We can still have some fun with the games, even if you can't go down to the store and buy them right now.
Glory of the internet, essentially, these games can last forever. So, you know, I think the podcast really has even shown us more than anything else that, you know, a lot of these games are still definitely kind of alive and kicking in their own way, even if they're no longer supported.
I do want to apologize to Mike here just because he's actually done an episode with us before, and I'm a moron. Actually lost the audio for it. So, We've talked to Mike before, and last time we spoke, Mike was still stranded in Canadian land. Is that still the case, Mike?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's actually a permanent fixture as well. I had planned to move up here eventually, just the COVID world kind of has expedited those plans a little faster than, you know, well, planned. But, you know, I'm adjusting to life north of the wall here and everything, and hopefully the border will open up at some point and I can go back down to where all my stuff is.
Priorities.
Speaking of you know, dead war games and everything, there's a literal treasure trove sitting in my place that has been, you know, abandoned for almost a year now. If anyone is brave or foolhardy enough to venture in, but I have to warn you, this is actually not COVID related, but the place is booby trapped entirely. That's just a general thing.
So for all the Dark Age fans out there, if David Moffat disappears, somebody please go check Michael's apartment for him.
Excuse me, you've seen, like, you know, The Last Crusade. Moffat is basically like that centurion that is still sitting there guarding everything. So, you know, he's your final test.
But as we discussed last time, it sounded like you didn't have a whole lot of opportunity or availability to do any hobbying up in Canada. So normally we ask people what they're up to, but I'm guessing it's still the case that unfortunately that's not really an option for you right now.
So being up here, you know, there's unfortunately I don't have any of my hobby stuff here. So I haven't painted miniatures in well over a year. My abilities are probably diminishing and dwindling down, but basically just spending a lot of my time doing actual just, you know, game dev and design, you know, standard work stuff. That's really what's done. And kind of gotten back into playing more video games than I used to. I wasn't a huge video gamer before, mainly just like some PC games and some select choices, you know, League of Legends and that stuff. But I stopped that a couple years ago at this point. But yeah, I've basically been getting back into, like, I don't want to say old school video games because we're talking like console games there, you know, like, oh, you know, the old Atari and the Nintendos. But you know, been doing a lot of that in between, like, just, to, you know, work stuff.
Right on. Chris, what have you been up to?
Well, you actually came to Jersey, so we got to get in a game of Eden, which was fantastic. And that kind of pushed me into finishing painting the rest of my Eden stuff that I had. I briefly checked out maybe getting into the Askari, read their rules, decided it was far too complicated, and kind of just went back to searching for those couple extra pieces for ISC that I didn't have before. And that's actually been about it hobby-wise because Monster Hunter Rise came out and I had to beat it.
Well, there you go. Have you beat it?
Yes, quite thoroughly at this point. Beat it, built my ideal endgame armor set. I've never been in a Monster Hunter game from the beginning before. Like, I'm used to jumping in when it's like, oh man, Iceborne's out. There's like, you know, a decade of DLC on this. Like, you know, so there's all this stuff to explore. This is the first time I got in where it's like, oh man, this is way more manageable at the beginning. But
so it actually comments on that somehow over the last, I was actually just having this conversation earlier today. I don't know how, but somehow over the last 2 weeks, I have clocked in 86 hours of Monster Hunter Rise.
Dang!
I don't exactly know when and how that happened, because I don't feel like I played it for that long, but here we are. But yeah, I'm in the same place of Owen. Like, I've kind of beaten everything, gotten my in-game stuff, and now I'm just waiting for the DLC to come out at the end of the month to get some more stuff on. So yeah, Owen, we should definitely, like, you know, hook up there some, play some games.
So that was actually Chris. I actually don't have a Switch.
Sorry. Whoops. Sorry.
That was a name slip.
Yeah, holy crap. Worries. Wait a minute. Have you two been reversed the entire time? Owen, how long have I known you? Chris, have you been Chris the whole time?
Maybe we're the same person.
That's doubtful. Very doubtful. But yeah, Owen actually doesn't own a Switch, so he's been sitting Rise out, unfortunately.
Ah, he's a dork. Gotcha.
Yeah, one of those dorks who doesn't have a video game console.
So Owen, what have you been up to hobby-wise, being that you haven't been consumed by Monster Hunter?
So I was traveling for work, which is why I was in New Jersey. So haven't been doing a whole heck of a lot. I have been painting some more of my Eden Force. We posted some pictures up of our game, so people probably noticed that my stuff wasn't fully painted. So just finalizing the Sargeriens I played. Then I've got the other box for the Sargeriens, and there's actually only two boxes and a blister for that faction. So my goal for the start of the summer is just to have that entire faction painted up and done and dusted, move on to bigger and better things after that. But for right now, that's what's sitting on my desk. But that about wraps up our hobby update. So let's talk about the reason we're here, which is the game Wrath of Kings. So I'll start off with a quick wiki style summary of the game. Wrath of Kings is an army skill tabletop war game designed by Michael Chennault and released by Simon Games in 2015. The game notably featured art by Edward Guton, you might know from places like Rackham or from all the other Simon games like Zombicide or the current Marvel United X-Men game that's on Kickstarter. Wrath of Kings was initially funded via Kickstarter and had some notably beautiful plastic miniatures. The most recent releases for the game were out in November 2017. The game uses approximately 20 to 30, it depends on game size, 28mm miniatures, D10 dice, and is commonly played on a 4x4 board. So, Michael, you're the fellow who designed this. Do you want to give people a quick overview of the background for Wrath of Kings?
So there was a bunch of different like elements that came together for that. You know, you had the game system, which was designed. You had the world setting, which was designed basically independently. So effectively, this was a fully big, ambitious project. So we had an entire world created around Edward Guton's artwork. That's kind of where it all started, was this kind of sketches and everything that he had like put together and made. And, you know, things evolved from there. And then, you know, we got this cohesive world put together with, you know, these really just five incredible looking factions that, you know, share that same aesthetic, but are also, you know, very, very unique in their regions and everything. And then, you know, the game mechanics were kind of the last thing that came together there once this world had been created.
Right on. So people have probably seen the miniatures for this. I still see them floating around to this day because they are gorgeous. Do you want to give people like a quick elevator pitch for each of the five houses?
Sure. So we had the Nasir, which was arguably the most popular faction and probably one of the second one that I believe was like kind of fleshed out and designed from an art perspective. Mm-hmm. And they kind of have this like demonic samurai look to them, where their entire culture is based around like these different masks that they can put on and gain different powers. But they definitely have a lot of the kind of Asian like aesthetics to them. Like if you're into the whole Japanese or Chinese like lore and mythology and that type of stuff, they carry that. You have the Garitzi, which is probably our most visually distinct one that people, like, when they think about the game, that's what they remember a lot of, is classic vampires and werewolves. A lot of our sculptors and, painters there came from the old, like, Confrontation and Rackholm backgrounds. And, you know, they carry that aesthetic there from some of those old lines. But that's if you want just these really cool werewolf miniatures mixed with vampires and that kind of, like dark Romanian, Transylvanian style like look. You have Technus, which were the pigmen, which I still think to this day are the most visually distinct unit in most any war game that you will see. And that's honestly, so the Nasir and the Garitzi are probably the fan favorites, but I think the most iconic for the line are the pigmen, because that's just, they were so different at the time that when people see them, they're like, oh my God, those are pigs in full plate armor. What's this? You know, that's something that no one had seen before. And, you know, that to me is still the iconic thing that like will separate Wrath of Kings from other games is that unit. Anyway, that's part of the Technus army, which kind of has this whole like steampunk aesthetic to it. And then pigmen, that's really the pitch there. I mean, if you like that idea, then there you go. You have Hadros, which another one of my favorite armies. I know I'm saying this a lot, but each one is so visually distinct. That's very hard for me to pick a favorite faction. It does flux a lot more than most any other games I've designed or played. Hadros is your aquatic kind of Cthulhu based army where you have the deep men who are all of it's like the cool and freaky stuff that lives underwater manifested into an army. So you've got like giant battle crabs. You have your kind of, like I said, Cthulhu-esque line troopers. You have sharkmen. I mean, anything that's like in the ocean that looks like it's deadly or creepy, which is pretty much everything in the ocean, you can have in that army. And then the last one you have is Shale Han, who was, they took inspiration, again, going back to the Asian kind of aesthetic, more Chinese focused on this one, though, where they had celestials. So they were like troops that were based around the zodiac, different animals, and then kind of carried this own, you know, Asian flair of them as well. But whereas the Nasir were more focused on like samurai and Japanese culture, Shale Han was more of the Chinese background. And, you know, kind of get that aesthetic where you're talking about the Celestials or like Journey to the West of like Sun Wukong and that type of like feel to them.
Right on. Awesome. Yeah, I think that that nails it. So we talked a little bit about the background. Chris, I know you were a really big fan of Wrath of Kings. Do you want to give people like just a quick summary of some of the unique aspects of the rules?
Yeah, I think the first thing that sets it apart is the way that you score points, or essentially the goal of the game, which is based on morale and motivations. So your morale for each army was based on how you built your army, the amount of models that you had, the ranks of the leaders that you had, and the motivations were essentially each faction had their choice of two different flavors of motivations. And you chose your motivation before the game, and that was the scenario that you were playing to, which usually led to an asymmetrical battle between you and your opponent. And instead of just scoring points using your motivation, you would actually cause morale loss to your opponent. So you could lower their morale through murdering their models. You could also lower their morale through scoring objectives, which was a pretty interesting kind of dual way of handling it. There was also a pretty unique deployment zone mechanic where you had different zones categorized by letter, and depending on what model you chose, that model went into a specific deployment zone, which were basically separated as bands from the backside of your table moving forward.
In terms of like really unique things, I think one of the things people might notice right away when they look at the Wrath of King cards is the table with 10 different results on each card. Do you want to talk about the unique, you know, one dice resolution system?
I think you can take that one.
Sure. So one of the things I really liked about Wrath of Kings, which separates it in my mind from a lot of other games in the same genre, is you don't have a separate hit and wound roll like you do in a lot of other army skill games. There's, if a model makes an attack, you roll some number of dice for that attack and then compare those results to a chart on whatever model you're attacking's card. Some of those results will be success, or the term that's used in the game is a strike. One result, a 10, is really good. That's an overpower, so that results in two hits. And then you have other types of results below that. These can be things like parry, it could be magical backlash, it could be a block. Anything that's not a strike or an overpower is a miss, but special rules interact with those in really interesting ways. And what's nice is this makes, from a back-of-the-envelope army scale calculation standpoint, okay, I'm rolling two dice. Anything above a 7 is hit. So I have a 30% chance of hitting with each attack. So I've got a 60% chance of doing at least one hit. You can do some really simple things with probability with that. I find it's a very light rule system, which I like, but it still maintains a lot of flavor, which I think is one of the things that you tend to lose pretty quickly when you start going to very, very simple systems. So I was always really impressed with how smooth that system worked.
Mike, was there anything else that you thought was interesting or unique about the rule set?
I mean, really the takeaway from Wrath of Kings, the main things that we wanted to do to set that aside was the motivations, I think, were good for the time. And you'll see a lot of those, like the cross-pollinated from Dark Age.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just basically trying out different systems other than just the whole, you know, like we're just going to wipe each other out. You know, that was really, when doing war games, that was always the most fun for me, was your scenario and objective play. And so incorporating that into the core mechanics of the game was very important. And then, as you said before, the one die resolution system played a big part into the overall design of the game as well, where one of the key aspects of the design for Wrath of Kings was to make a streamlined and simple system that still had layers on top of it. And that's something we've strived, you know, in every aspect of game design, you know, moving forward. Because, you know, a lot of the games, like in the past, like, I'm going to use Chainmail for an example, because that's, you know, bringing up some old dead war games. Chainmail is a tactical small skirmish game, but plays out very much like you're playing a D&D session, not only in its narrative capabilities, but also its complexity, because you've got charts, you've got different abilities to, you know, reference here and everything. And it can be very intimidating for, you know, people just trying to get into the game, where you've got to cross-reference charts, you've got to know all these little like subcontext rules and everything, and it can create a big barrier to entry. And that was one of the design ideas, you know, that is tied into, you know, not only just the design of the game, but also the product line, the marketing, all of that, you know, making it accessible. And at the time that the game came out, you were seeing this boom of, that was kind of like the trend here, is like people, their time was the most valuable thing they had, and it's definitely still the case now. But, you know, people just wouldn't become as invested in lines as they would like back in the 90s or the early 2000s, that where, you know, say I've got, you know, I want to get into like Warhammer or something like that. Well, I can devote, you know, months of my time to learn all the intricacies of that game, and I'm going to get super, super invested. But nowadays, and especially like during that period, if, you know, people, they didn't have the time they used to. That's how it feels like. I don't know if that's just a generational thing, or, you know, got older, you know, people's attention spans changed. But, you know, previously you would have like 4 to 6 hours or something to play a game, and that'd be fine. But that was not the case anymore. You know, people wanted quick games where they could get it done in an hour and a half and then go about their lives, you know, because that might be the only free time they have.
I mean, do you think that's a general trend the industry went through? Do you think this is going to be cyclical, or do you think this is a more constant thing? Like going forward, we're not going to see as many chainmail style games just because that's just not what people want anymore out of a war game.
I think there'll always be a demand for them, but there's always going to be just the greater, like, what does the industry and the hobby industry as a whole want? Mm-hmm. And that trend kind of goes a lot with, you know, just the things you'll see in like video games and, you know, things like that, where you'll see in movies as well to some degree. You know, you see the trends that develop and everything. But from my personal, and I think that there'll always be a demand for like those super in-depth, super like crunchy games, like, you know, where like, yeah, you know, I'm going to, you know, re-referencing a chart, and to create my army, you know, I've got to like pick, you know, a ton of different variables. There's some that really like that aspect of things, you know, that can appeal to me as well. Actually, going back to when we were talking about Monster Hunter, you know, earlier, optimization, you know, that game is not specifically hard to just pick up and play, especially the new one. But to master it, there's a huge level of complexity that, you know, you just scratch the surface on, that if you're playing casually, you're never even going to see. And that's kind of like, you know, I think it's a good solid design philosophy when it comes to games, that you want a system that is streamlined and accessible. So like, if you're going to treat this like, for example, say a board game, if I've got my Wrath of Kings starter box and I just want to open up occasionally and just play with someone just based on the starter box stuff, I should be able to do that. But if you're one of those people that want to take it to the next level and actually get in depth and go to like tournament play, you're going to see all these new layers of complexity and nuance that you're not going to see elsewhere. I mean, you can just do the basic comparison of like chess. You know, chess, very simple game to explain and learn, but there's a vast difference between someone just playing casually and then high rank, you know, world standard play.
Speaking of complexity in the game and things that may, I think, probably are a little bit deceptively complex, one of the things I really liked about Wrath of Kings was the system for combined activations. Do you want to just cover that real quickly?
So essentially in the game, one of the things is that unlike traditional war games, you don't have squads or set like units. Well, sorry, everything in the game is called a unit, but you don't have basically set squads. You know, I'm not going to buy like a group of Nasir swordsmen and like there's five of them. Instead, your entire army can cohesively function together. And the way that works is that everything's keyed off of your leaders. And basically, it's to represent them giving commands and orders on the battlefield. So when it's your turn, instead of activating, you can activate a single model if you want. But if there's a leader nearby, they can coordinate their troops and group them together to give them a combined activation. So this group of three is going to activate, or this group of five is going to activate. And that number was based on the game level and the commander that you were taking. Some could, you know, command more guys in a single time than others. So it might be beneficial. They're like, okay, there's an objective over here. I'm going to activate these three guys and send them over there to claim the objective, pick it up, do whatever I need to. Later on in the fight, you go like, okay, I need to just run forward and kill as many enemies as I can. So I'm going to activate all five of these guys here in one group activation, take them together, and go and attack these guys. That also opened up the aspect to doing combined attacks. So you had these like big monsters or tough defense guys in the game. You could have your little grunt guys combine their actions together into one super attack to basically pierce the defense of that one enemy. Because like, okay, say you've got this big tanky defensive swordsman and he's just one-on-one, he's going to kick the ass of anyone in your army. But all of a sudden you have three guys at once ganging up on him. His defenses just can't be everywhere at once. So that was another tactical aspect, was choosing how many guys you're going to devote to an attack. Basically, all of your troops were a resource. I mean, that's really what it breaks down to in most any war game. Everything is a resource. This was another way of doing that. So, you know, how many resources am I going to throw with this problem to make it go away? Was essentially what one of your main choices was in the game.
Right on. Yeah, I would say too, one of the things I really liked about the combined activation system was the interaction with inspire abilities on leaders. So if you shared a trait with a leader and you were chosen to activate in a combined activation in that leader's sphere of influence, you'd gain some extra advantage. Now, a leader didn't necessarily have to share a trait with you to pick you for a combined activation if you were in their sphere of influence, but if he did, there was a benefit to it, which added a nice, interesting layer to army building. So was that benefit worth only taking one trait, or were you better off mixing some traits in to get some new abilities at the cost of not potentially getting that extra oomph from the inspire? That's something I really liked as like a layer of nuance on an otherwise very, very simple and straightforward system.
And you're kind of touching on a lot of the cornerstones of the design of Wrath of Kings, was that all the core mechanics and the core systems were by design meant to be very simplistic. But that's, again, the complexity shouldn't come from the base mechanics. Those should be simple by design. But then you have all these extra layers. You have your troops, you have your commanders, you have the influence, the way that they're going to interact. You have all the abilities on your type of troops. And this is, troops themselves had traits, so you could only group them together if they shared a trait. Well, as more units came out, you had different varieties, which again opened up more combo play. And then this is not even talking about just general list building, which list building is probably my favorite aspect of any war game. Is that I just sit there and I can just make different lists, and you know, without even playing the game, that's really the fun thing. It's like, oh, what's this combination do? What's this combo do? And Wrath of Kings was rife with that, where like, okay, I could build an entire like Nasir list and focus on one type of troop so that all my leaders synergized with all these troops, and this is what they did. On the other hand, I could diversify and go like, okay, I'm going to take a smattering of like these type of troops, which are going to give me other options to how the army plays. But now do I want to take a leader that benefits them, or do I want to stick to my initial plan, or do I want to treat this as just this little fringe unit that does their own thing?
Right on. Well, speaking of that, Chris, do you want to cover some reasons people might really like Wrath of Kings if they haven't already invested into it?
I think the first and foremost reason and what drew me to Wrath of Kings was that kind of what Mike touched on in the very beginning of the episode is that each one of the armies is very unique. You know, when you look, especially as someone who, like, when I look into a new game, I'm like, okay, what army does this game have that other games don't have? This was basically a game where every single army was an army that didn't really exist somewhere else, you know, between one army basically being horror, you know, werewolves, zombies, or sorry, werewolves, vampires, and the humans who somehow live in that area and don't die. You know, Nasir had all the strange, like, magical powered mask people. And especially being that this was before Warhammer Age of Sigmar came out with undersea elves, this was really the first undersea army that I had really seen in a game. So on and so forth. It's definitely a very unique looking game. I also think that, you know, if you like a game that's affordably priced, Wrath of Kings was great. There was a lot of great value in the starter boxes where you would end up with a large amount of models for a very reasonable price. I think most of the time the MSRP was somewhere around $50, if I remember right. And you would get way more models than you would think. You would typically get, was it just about two full units of the base units for whatever the army was. So like if you were getting the Garitzi starter, you would get a unit of werewolves, you'd get a unit of vampires, you'd get a vampire leader, and you'd get a werewolf leader, which and you'd also get one of the specialists. I think it came with the shield breaker.
There's a shield breaker in the Garitzi starter box. Yes, you actually got two different specialists. You got the I forget what it was called, the little come hither werewolf, and then you also got a shield breaker, which that's one of the coolest models ever sculpted. I'm just going to go ahead and say that.
Yep.
Yeah, the shield breaker was definitely really awesome. And then, yeah, some of the other things we already hit on, you know, it was a army scale game that doesn't really take a lot of time to play, which is, you know, was pretty innovative at the time. I know people have found ways to reduce the amount of time it takes to play 40K or Age of Sigmar, but you can still play Wrath of Kings faster than those games, which is always beneficial, you know, because even if you have more time to play, that means you can play three games of Wrath of Kings, and you know, instead of just playing one. And I think the last thing I can think of is really just looking at a war game. If you want a game that's pretty easy to learn the basics of, but that you still have room to kind of expand before you hit that ceiling, it's a really good game because it's definitely a very easy to learn system.
Yeah, I would say it's approachable. I think sometimes people will say easy to learn almost as kind of like a backhanded compliment. It's not a simple game in that there's no complexity. It's a fairly complex game, but it's intuitive to walk up to the table and understand how things work. And I think that's rare. And it's one of the things I really do like about Wrath of Kings. Speaking of the lovely models, though, that you mentioned before, Chris, I'll start with Mike. Mike, did you have any favorite models from the Wrath of Kings lines?
Man, I really do have to gush here that I love so many models from this game system line just for various reasons. Like, you really have to pick a faction, and I would even, regardless of the faction, I think I would have a tough time giving you even a top three. But the ones that come to my mind if you asked that question, Preston, was first off the Shieldbreaker, because it's a giant werewolf in steampunk armor with a battle axe. I mean, come on. But then later on, we also released the Gothica Knights, which were knight versions of that same model. So you had werewolves in like knight armor with, you know, fencing blades and things like that. And the leader had a giant scythe. For Hadros, you have Sharkmen, you have Jellyfishmen, you have a giant armored hermit battle crab. For Nasir, so Nasir, a lot of people like the samurai aesthetics and everything. That I actually have to say, like, probably visually one of my lower on the tier. But that's not to say they're not good. Just everything else is just, that's how much it stands out to me. Like the standard Ashman swordsmen are really cool looking. And yeah, they've got some big cool looking demon guys. But I mean, I think it says something that when I can say the big cool demon guys and demonic samurai guys are like the fourth tier as far as like my favorite models go, that should say something about the line. Then yep. You have Technus, who had, again, the armored battle pigs, and not even talking about the flying evil babies. And Shale Han, I know a lot of people, like, a big fan favorite was the Celestials and that style of aesthetic. For me, it didn't really resonate too much with me, so they're actually pretty low on the list as well. Even, like, and it almost sounds like the hipster thing to go, because they were one of the most popular, like, model lines. But to me, like they were probably the fourth tier as far as like the stuff I really liked, with Nasir probably being at the lowest. And I say that with any other like game line I almost compared to, or some other. I shouldn't say that. That sounds a little insulting. But compared to a lot of the models I've seen just across catalogs, the fact that those two are like, yeah, my fourth and fifth tier picks for the game are still some of the highest ones in miniatures.
Right on, Chris. How about you?
So, for me, my go-to army was always Garitzi, but I only played werewolves in Garitzi. So, my favorite models, like, from an aesthetic standpoint, were actually the ones that I unfortunately never got the chance to actually get in my hands. I really loved the ways that the Gritzy White Mane duelists looked. It was awesome because it had like a very almost like French feel to it between the armor, like the very musketeers looking armor and like almost suit shirt underneath, you know, the way that the hair was coming off of the these female werewolves. Everything was proportioned right. There was no bikini chainmail. Like it was done just super well. And similarly, I also really liked the Gotham Knights because I liked seeing the werewolves that weren't just kind of more feral werewolves, loincloth and blade, but actually seeing some heavily armored bruiser characters, especially the leader for them with that huge scythe. For models that I actually owned, the Shieldbreaker would probably be my favorite. Just I really enjoyed painting up all the armor detail that existed on that model. And I think I actually had owned four of them. It's just because like I enjoyed painting the model so much. There was really no good way to put four of them into an army. The reason, but like if I said, you know, if I went into a game store wanting to pick just something up because I spent time in the game store, that was usually like a go-to box because it came in the specialist box I keep forgetting what the female model was with like the claw and the
Zeddy. Am I remembering that right? I know what you're talking about.
It might have been this Scourge Hound.
The Scourge Hound was the Zeddy werewolf. Yes, that was the name I was trying to remember earlier.
Yep, but yeah, so I would just pick it up and take it home and have fun painting it. So I had all different like color werewolf fur. You know, some were wearing armor that was like brighter, newer. Some were wearing armor that was like had battle damage and was like, you know, all rusted up. So I really enjoyed that model, and it was priced to be a fun like painting project and way to support like the LGS.
Nice, man. So for me, I'm a big Hadros fan, and when I saw the Deep Caller, that's what sold the game for me. It's one of the Hadros specialists. It's got it almost looks like the Legend of Zelda Triforce icon on its staff. It definitely captures a lot of the design feel for the rest of the faction. So it's got kind of a Deep Man, like the Hadros Deep Man, not the H.P. Lovecraft Deep Man face, so the tentacle thing going on. It's just looks very... Deep Color, thank you. It just looks very otherworldly, and I actually have a resin copy of it from when the game was first being discussed. I'm really happy I have it. It's been a treat to paint, so definitely what got me into the game. But I think a close second, closer to the last set of releases, has to be the Azari Warhounds for Nasir, which are guys with demon mask on who are holding back with chains dogs with demon mask on. And there's just something about the doggo and the demon mask that just... scratches the itch for me. So
actually, I'll side with you on that. That's probably one of my favorite Nasir sculpts as well.
Cool. Well, thank you for joining us, Mike. We actually just had a couple of questions since, you know, I think you are definitely the person to ask for this stuff on some things around Wrath of Kings. So do you have any favorite stories from the development of Wrath of Kings?
There were a few stories that surround and everything, namely due to like from playtesting, things like that. But some of them that I just don't really know if I can bring up for various reasons, but I remember like, I'm sorry, I can't really answer that question because the one story I want to tell is probably not appropriate because it has to do with a less than savory incident we had at a convention with a attendee, because I will not say a fan. This guy was definitely not a fan of our stuff. But it's the one that sticks out that when you ask me there, and I know that's unfortunately super vague and doesn't actually say anything. But that's kind of dominating my mind right now. Is we had I even don't want to use the word altercation because that's not even the thing to mention. I guess I will say what I can is that so we had all of our models for display and everything that was set up. We had the game there and everything. And this guy, I honestly do not know why he was at a gaming convention. Like just the way he acted and everything. But he took some super big offense to our models and wanted to let everyone involved know about it. And I just remember, because that's not really so much Wrath of Kings related, this is more like crazy convention story related, but just thinking like, what is this guy's deal? Like, what what has caused this and why is he here? So that's unfortunately dominating my thought right now about like just weird stuff related to Wrath of Kings.
Right on. So looking back after you had an expansion book for Wrath of Kings, you had the main book, and that was all stuff you worked on. Is there anything, you know, retrospectively looking back now that you would have done differently with the rules design or that you wish you had gotten in those two releases?
So there were a couple like core mechanics that we had alternate ways that we were considering like making them function. And, you know, that's always the choice there of like, you know, you pick the one you think is the best. And then you always have that itch in your head to like, you know, could we have done it a little, if we'd gone of option B, what would have been the effects? Mm-hmm. That is a couple things that came up. But really, I think the biggest thing was having to go back and just like do some additional, like not clarification, but streamlining. Because while we streamlined a lot of the process and everything, I still feel like there are some things that are a little clunky. And that was really the big thing for me there. And also opening up some extra motivations we had before we moved on to other projects. That was another thing there. But if there was like any one thing that actually, if I could go back and change, and this is going to be a bit of a strange one, but I guess that's the type of thing you asked for. So we made the Ancient King model for the Kickstarter. And originally it was just a model because it was they can't have game rules. This is literally the guy who conquered the world and then disappeared and set across the events of the storyline. There's no conceivable way an army could actually like fight him. That's how powerful he was in the story. Well, we made a rules card for him, and it literally like he was unkillable, he was undamageable, and after two turns, you just won the game by having him because your opponent was just in such awe about his raw power. The list building requirements for him also meant that you could only play him in a game that was 5 times the largest game size that we offered at the time. So everything about that card was just, you know, meant to be just like over the top and a joke. You know, here's a card because, you know, you want him. So literally he by himself can only like he can one-on-one being him versus an army 5 times the largest size we offer. And he still wins after 2 turns, ignoring the fact that you actually can't hurt him in those 2 turns regardless. I would still see every so often pop up people online, the Facebook group and all that, going, hey, this guy's busted. What the hell? And it'd be like, what gave it away, man? Like, you know, was it the fact that his attack literally kills anything in the game in one hit and that it can't miss? Or the fact that by his defense chart, you actually can't hurt him? Or was it by the fact that you can't field him in a normal game? Like, not you can't even not field him in a large size game, but the amount of models you would have to have is unreasonably large. Like, did none of these things like give a hint that maybe this guy is not meant to be played normally? But you would have these people, and if it was a joke, okay, I'd understand that. But you had some people that legitimately were posting up like, this guy's really busted. Like, you know, what's the deal? I'm like, can you not see that? And can you not like how are you getting to the point where you're getting so worked up about this that you're going and posting online to figure this out and not just going, oh, I get it. But that was kind of my one thing that consistently came up every few months. And it was just like, man, really? We didn't print on the card, like, you know, that specific thing saying this is a joke, don't take it seriously. But every time I saw that, I was like, I really wish I had printed something on that card to say something along those lines just to keep this from happening. But then again, it probably would have still happened anyway.
I'm just imagining you getting questions about that via Facebook DM and just responding with the never ask me for anything again .gif from Smash Brothers.
Well, it's a similar thing. I didn't learn my lesson because Future in Song of Ice and Fire, we made a George R. R. Martin miniature that's called the High Sinus Shawl, which was a Kickstarter exclusive. He has no in-game you can take him. He is free to include in any army. He has no in-game effect because his rules card basically states he can't do anything and affect the battle in any way, shape, or form. The only rule that he has is that if you win the game, you get to decide, and when you retell the events of that game, you get to decide every single event that happened in that game, and your opponent cannot retort or refute them. So if you won the game and you were like, yeah, you know, we were on turn 3 and then Owen just all of a sudden decided to march his leader directly up to mine and say, man, I'm going to kick your ass. And even though it was the worst possible play, you know, and then he just lost and, you know, he started crying afterwards. Owen could not refute that. Conversely, though, if you lost the game, the winner was the one that got to declare what happened. So Owen could just flip that around. You know, so that was a fun little thing there. But same thing, we still occasionally see posts there, people going, isn't this guy busted because he's free? Like, did you read the cost and literally nothing else on the card?
Like, I think Chris actually had a run in at an event. Someone trying to run the Agent King. Am I remembering that right?
Yep. I had run an event in Jersey, and someone was literally just trying to put it into the army. I think they were actually trying to play both the Ancient King and Eagle Eyes, Iron Eyes.
Iron Eyes. That's the thing. She was not allowed in competitive play just because of availability, but she was not like overpowered or anything.
She was stronger than a lot of the other point options that you could take. But yeah, the biggest issue there was the availability for her. But yeah, this person was just like, yeah, I can run these two models, like, you know, they're Wrath of Kings models. And it's like, well, you're missing on number one, the list building, and number two, that this is a competitive event, and both of those aren't allowed in competitive play. And the player was just really, really like salty about it, of like, oh, you know, show me where in the rules, like, it says that.
Show me where it says a dog can't play baseball.
Right. But, I mean, for that to be the one and only negative experience I've had with, like, Wrath of Kings, I, and these things just kind of happen, you know. But, yeah, some people just don't get it. But, you know, it's one of those things, too, where if you let that go through, then that leads to basically every other person at the tournament having a sad time.
Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, we had you on before, unfortunately, to hear that. But I don't want to bore you to death, so we came up with some new questions to ask you since we asked you the original ones already. Chris, you want to take it away on these?
Sure. So if you took all the Dark Age Immortal winners together and it was one big Thunderdome death match, who's coming out alive?
So there's an obvious answer, then there's the actual answer. The obvious answer would be the one who is a trained MMA fighter. Oh, geez, and now the name is escaping me. God, that's like the type of thing that gets a hit put out on you.
John Carter.
This is the thing that gets you beat up by a trained MMA fighter.
Mr. John Carter himself, you know, our actual MMA fighter. But I think that, you know, one of the answers could probably be Mark Bearlove, just because John Carter's a nice guy, and that's kind of a disadvantage when it's coming to winning a fight, if it's not a fair fight. Mark, I could see just before the actual fight happens, it's like, okay, everyone shows up to like the designated fight area, and all of a sudden John's not there, and it's like, what happened? And Mark's just, you know, like, I don't know, I guess something happened to him before the fight, like in his sleep or something. You know, the MMA fighting doesn't really help you there. And then just proceed to, like, you know, just win via unscrupulous means. Or, like, yeah, no one else shows up to the fight. They just all had mysterious accidents over the last week.
Right on. What's your favorite FromSoft game?
Oh, that fluxes. I would have to say in my ranking order of From Software games, my favorite would actually probably have to be Sekiro. And I say that's probably the best first-time playthrough experience of a From Software game. The problem is that I don't have any really desire to replay that game. That title holds Dark Souls 3. That's the one I'll replay over and over and over again. Sekiro, I feel, was the best first-time playthrough. And then it kind of junctions between, like, Dark Souls 1 Remastered is really good as well. I just finished playing Demon Souls Remake for the PS5. I really enjoyed that. I feel that that's a very consolidated Dark Souls experience. It's, you know, whatever, Soulsborne. Bloodborne is way up there high. It's the problem is I played that game so much for work that, you know, I will not play it again for some time. And unfortunately, this is unexpected, I know, but Dark Souls 2 is way at the bottom of that list.
I'm shocked. Nobody else has ever expressed that opinion.
Listen, I feel real. I'm more disappointed in that game than anything else because it had a lot of cool ideas and potential. Just all the execution is not great. And the thing is, if you actually look at the development of how that game played out, I don't hold like anyone who created that game responsible, because if you look at everything, like the nightmare that was, that you can find documentaries on this on YouTube just all day, but I feel for everyone who worked on that project and like feel like, you know what, for what that game ended up being, you guys did good. It just wasn't a very good game, unfortunately.
If people want to support the projects you currently work on, what games do you have coming out, and what games can they go pick up to help support you?
Well, currently we have, you know, Song of Ice and Fire, which is, as of the recording of this, we have the Greyjoy faction releasing very soon. We have Masters of the Universe is my next project that we have announced and we are dealing with. I've got a few other projects coming out in the near future, and by that I mean the next, like, 12 to 18 months that are going to be really interesting for people, but I can't talk about them. So I'm going to fall into that category of, yeah, we got some really cool stuff coming, and man, I can't talk about it, but man, it's going to be cool. which, you know, unfortunately there. Bloodborne, the board game, also has just recently hit retail, or should soon. I don't actually know. I know that we delivered the Kickstarter and everything a few months back, but retail, it should either be out now or coming out soon, which also explains, by the way, why, while I do like Bloodborne, the video game, I played through the game. I've put more hours in that game literally than I think the rest of my top 5/10 games combined due to all the research from making the board game there. So, I mean, when I'm playing other Soulsborne games as my means of relaxing, like, that should say something. So that we have that currently coming out, and I believe that's going to be it for right now. And then currently on our Kickstarter, as you mentioned, we have our Marvel United X-Men standalone core game and expansion that is on Kickstarter day two right now, as of the time of this recording. That was done by Andrea Charvaschio and Eric Lang from, you know, both fantastic board game designers, and that is currently coming up. That is, you know, a must for any Marvel or X-Men fan, or, you know, anyone who just really likes, you know, fun games as well.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of board game Kickstarters. I did do this one for no other reason that the video showing off the components of the game is a loving homage to the 1990s X-Men animated show. I like it. I could hear the, you know, start like playing in my head when I watched it. So thumbs up for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of the iconic, like, you could have an entire episode just talking about cool 90s intros.
I don't know if, like, Chris and I are like the loving 90s nostalgia types. I had to live through snap bracelets and hammer pants. I'm not saying that's the same as, like, surviving Vietnam, but I'm not saying it.
Now listen, we can break out, like, the pogs and everything, too, if you want to get into it.
Pogs, the ultimate dead game.
Man, yeah, we missed opportunities here.
Oh, mercy. All right, Mike, anything else you want to say?
No, I mean, it was great talking to you guys, you know, just like last time, although I guess that one's lost to the void forever. But
yeah, you know, it's a shame that people won't ever hear, like, the secrets about you know, all those things you revealed about Dark Age. But hey, c'est la vie. Thank you for coming out. We really appreciate you being here. And on that note, I'm Owen.
And I'm Chris.
All right, and I'm Michael from CMON.
And this is the Dead Wargamer Society.
Intro music is Axe to Mouth by Pulp 45, which is Owen's old band. Outro music is Control My Fate by Ataraxia, which is Chris's old band. All songs used with permission. If you like what you hear, please like or subscribe. Thanks.